Well, good afternoon, everyone. It's a privilege to be here today with our three distinguished panelists and with all of you as we come together to discuss the critical role of faith-based organizations in addressing the HIV pandemic. I'm Jack DeGioia. I'm the president of Georgetown University here in Washington, D.C. Loyal alumni. And I'm truly honored to have this opportunity to share this afternoon with you. Unfortunately, Dr. Hani Elbana could not be with us this afternoon, but I know we're looking forward all to an excellent dialogue with the three leaders on our panel. I'd especially like to take this moment to thank Ambassador Mark Dybul, who served as the United States Global AIDS Coordinator under President George W. Bush, and who is now the co-director of Georgetown's O'Neill Institute for National and Global Health Law, for his efforts to bring us together today. I wish to offer some very brief comments to frame our discussion and introduce our panelists, and then we'll begin the conversation. In December of 2009, the Joint United Nations Program on HIV/AIDS, UNAIDS, published a strategic framework that described the organization's commitment to developing stronger partnerships with faith-based organizations in the fight against HIV/AIDS. The report discussed the critical participation of faith-based organizations in providing HIV-related services, from clinical care to HIV prevention education to pastoral and spiritual guidance. Without broader collaboration, the report argued, it would be very difficult to achieve the shared goal of universal access to HIV prevention, treatment, care, and support. Our panel today reflects the significant shifts that are taking place throughout the international AIDS community as the importance of involving faith-based organizations in effective responses to HIV/AIDS becomes more widely understood. Now more than ever, there's an opportunity to pursue strong and enduring partnerships with faith-based organizations to, quote, turn the tide together, close quote, on HIV/AIDS. Kay Warren's ongoing work in Western Rwanda provides an extraordinary example of what these partnerships can look like. Her leadership of the Saddleback Church HIV/AIDS Initiative, which includes the Western Rwanda HIV/AIDS Healthcare Initiative Project, is a model of engagement. This initiative focuses on collaboration between Saddleback Church, the Rwandan Ministry of Health, the country's National AIDS Control Commissions, state hospitals, churches, and USAID to develop an innovative, decentralized approach to healthcare more capable of reaching those populations in need. Collaboration also has been strengthened within the faith community across organizations representing different faiths. And another member of our panel, Dr. Frameha Bunchwi Dujai, provides leadership at the Asian Interfaith Network on AIDS and has been particularly important to advancing this type of partnership as he has worked to bring together Buddhist, Hindu, Muslim, and Christian representatives to develop faith-based responses to the challenges of HIV/AIDS. Through Monrela, Reverend McDonald Sebarika, who serves as executive director, has extended the organization's commitment to being an interfaith network open to members of all faiths who wish to mitigate HIV and AIDS-related stigma, silence, denial, discrimination, inaction, and misaction through their brave identification with the pandemic. These profound commitments to advancing collaboration resonate deeply with the approach that we have taken at Georgetown University in support of the international response to HIV/AIDS. As a Catholic and Jesuit university, we are guided by a responsibility embedded in our tradition to engage the most challenging issues of our time in service of the greater glory of God and the betterment of humankind. In the context of HIV/AIDS, we seek to meet this responsibility by engaging the resources of our university, excellent research and scholarship, the ability to convene leaders, and to support greater capacity building among organizations engaged in frontline work to help develop the network of partnerships and collaborations required to meet the shared goal of universal access. As we continue to pursue this work, we are especially grateful to be a part of this critical meeting of the international AIDS community, and I'm honored to have the opportunity to moderate today's discussion between these deeply committed faith leaders. Now I'm going to join them and launch our dialogue, and I want to thank you all for being here and being a part of this important dialogue. So I think it will be best if we ground our conversation in the concrete work that you are each already engaged in, and then we can move from that concrete framework and discuss some of the learning that has occurred over the course of the years of your engagement. So let's start with you, Kay. Give us a sense of the nature of the work that you've been engaged in with Saddleback Church, particularly the work in Western Rwanda.
Sure. Well, in 2005, the president of Rwanda, President Paul Kagame, was given my husband's book, The Purpose-Driven Life. And it was given to him because he said that the theme of his life was purpose. And a mutual friend said, well, then I have a book for you. And when President Kagame read The Purpose-Driven Life, he wrote to my husband and said, would you come to Rwanda and do here, would you help us become a purpose-driven nation? And so we came to Rwanda at the invitation of the government. And what we found there instantly was a collaboration between government, between the business community, and between the faith leaders. And what we have come to believe is that when there is that kind of synergy between the government, between private sector, and between the church, the faith community, that there is traction that can be gained on almost any issue that you want to address. And so as we came to Rwanda to learn, to listen, to build partnerships and friendships with the Rwandan churches, we soon found that they were very interested in some of the same things we were, which was how do you address the basic issues that people deal with? How do you deal with the spiritual emptiness that everyone experiences at some point in their life? How do you deal with corrupt leadership? How do you deal with poverty? How do you deal with pandemic disease? How do you deal with educating the next generation? And so through what we call the peace plan that addresses each of those five issues by promoting reconciliation between people and in their spiritual harmony between them and God. As we address that need of corrupt leadership with equipping servant leaders to assist the poor, to care for the sick, and then to educate the next generation. As we worked with pastors and elevated the role of pastors so that they were no longer seen as just provincial people who had really nothing to contribute, but they were equal partners that the government then began to listen to, we were able to create a synergy that began to tackle each of those issues in Rwanda in partnership with them. In particular, in the western province of Rwanda, which had been hit very hard by the genocide in 1994, the government said this is a rural area that was hit extremely hard. It's very, very poor, not a lot of services there, and could the peace plan possibly be effective in this rural area? And they asked us to go and collaborate with the pastors there, with the government leaders there, with the private sector. And so as we have done that since 2005, there's a pilot project that we're particularly proud of that I'll tell you more about, but it is a process to train community health workers. In 4 years, we have been able to train, by the end of this year, 7,000 community health volunteers who have a caseload of 7 homes. And they make over 100,000 home visits a year, and I'll talk more about that later, but that's particularly the pilot program that have been very pleased with what's happened there.
Thank you very much. McDonald, place this in the context of Malawi and the work of Manrila.
Yeah, thank you so much. Perhaps there are people here who are saying, oh hell no, this faith language has hurt us. Indeed, it is important for us as faith communities to realize that we have hurt people. Much as we have done a lot, But there are people who, up to now, don't want to hear anything about the church because of perhaps the way we are as faith communities have approached HIV and issues related to it. And it's important for us to make sure that we confess of the sins of omission we have tended to commit. Coming to the issues around my work in Malawi, in the context of Malawi and largely Africa, where about nearly 50% of health services are provided for by faith communities, which is quite enormous. But at the same time, the faith communities have the biggest network that reach the most hard-to-reach areas in countries that perhaps the government system does not reach. It is important to recognize that faith communities can be utilized as a means of reaching those people who otherwise would have not accessed support and services. In my work has entailed that we realized that as faith communities and religious leaders, there was a certain level of obscurity of a face of religious leaders who are living with HIV. It was about them and us. HIV has tended to elude perhaps the leadership of the church and the faith community, and connected HIV to the people on the streets and perhaps those we classify as outsiders or outcasts, and tend to condemn them to go to hell before even God has tended to invite them to go to heaven. To that effect, I think our role has been as the network of religious leaders living with HIV in Africa and in Malawi. We had to mobilize religious leaders, make sure that they provide support for religious leaders to come out in the open and have a support system among themselves and ensure that they provide leadership within their faith communities to turn the tide against HIV and give it a human face and ensure that stigma is fought to the last. Certainly, this has we have currently a membership of 1,500 religious leaders, and I'm saying religious leaders, not just the membership. So, to the extent that these religious leaders have championed issues of fighting stigma, discrimination, shame, denial, inaction, and misaction. They've championed the issues of a comprehensive faith response. For a long time, faith communities have tended to be very comfortable with the AB, but we have said AB leaves out quite a lot of other things. It leaves about transmission of mother to child of the disease. Certainly, it leaves out issues of what about issues of gender and the interconnectedness of gender-based violence vis-a-vis HIV and AIDS, which seems to be gender-based violence in our part of the world tends to be a driver to the epidemic. We have also mobilized faith communities to create structures at all levels that ensures that it takes care of people living with HIV and embraces the epidemic to the fullest, to the extent that the faith communities should be HIV compliant and competent and understand the dynamics of the epidemic, that the epidemic is not about morality. The epidemic goes beyond morality, but it's a dynamic epidemic and it requires a very comprehensive and dynamic response.
Thank you. Thank you very much. So take us to Thailand and tell us a little bit about the interfaith network that you've been able to put in place to address.
Thank you very much. And in case of Thailand, in the very early 1980, when the first case of AIDS was reported. So, you know, it is almost, I think, the same situation with almost every country that people are, you know, fear and they don't know how to deal with the epidemic. And including, you know, the faith-based organization in Thailand. So we don't know how to deal with the pandemic. So later on, many of the temple which situated in the society, they start doing the work by, you know, accepting the people who are living with HIV to stay in the temple, because they are denied by the community, they are denied by their family, so where to live? It is only the place that is the temple for them to live and to prolong their life. And of course, the religious leader, I mean the monks who are there in the temple, can take care of them. And also, finally, if they are dying, then that is the duty of the monks and of the religious leader to perform the ritual for their last, you know. And from then on, monks and religious leader try to learn how to work, and it is very difficult at the moment. But later on, and with the cooperation with many of the organization in Thailand, you know, monks can have an experience of learning how to work to deal with HIV and AIDS. And they start having more tempo to accept the people living with HIV to stay and to live there. And after that, we try to work collaboratively by the name of the Interfaith Network, which is really very important moment in the years of 2003, we met after long times working. We meet together and we form the network of Interfaith Network on HIV/AIDS in Thailand. And we get the support from the government and also from the Global Fund to run the program of care and support for people living with HIV and for those who are vulnerable children, and also for the elderly. So with that program, it is it makes, you know, Thailand more visible in the world, that in case of Thailand, in terms of prevention and in terms of care and support, it is very remarkable and very good, very best practice in the world, that many countries go there to Thailand and to learn from the Thai experience.
Thank you. Thank you so much. So we have a little bit of a feel for the concrete nature of the work that you're doing, but before we go further, I'd like to get a sense of your own personal process of discernment. How did you know? When did you know? Through what process did you realize you were called to do this kind of work
at this time in your lives? I'd be very interested to hear what you have to say. Kate, maybe you can get us started.
Wow, you have 3 hours. It was a very unexpected journey for me. I was a busy pastor's wife, raising kids, being involved in my church. I was a good mom, a good wife, good neighbor. I just didn't care about HIV. I didn't know anything about it, really. I had basically ignored it all the years of the pandemic. And 2 months ago, in March of 2002, I was reading a news magazine article in my house, and it had a story about AIDS in Africa. And, looking back, I can say I have no idea why I read it, because I didn't care. But I opened it, and I began to read it, and it was so compelling and riveting that I didn't know what to do. The pictures that accompanied this article were the kind that most of us just try to turn those pages really fast, because the pictures are so graphic and so horrible. People dying and emaciated. And yet I was determined to read the article, even though I couldn't look at the pictures. And so I covered my face with my hands like this. I literally did. And I was determined I was going to read the article and block out the pictures with my fingers. That's the same way I watch horror movies. It makes the monster about this big. And in that moment, AIDS was the monster, and I was trying to block it out. But there was this little box in the middle of the article that said 12 million children orphaned in Africa due to AIDS. That shocked me. And I threw the magazine down on the ground. I got up from my couch where I was sitting drinking tea, and I thought to myself, this is impossible. This cannot possibly be true. This is an exaggeration. If this were so, I would know it. How could there be 12 million children orphaned on one continent and I not know a single one of them? That time they were saying 40 million people infected with HIV. And so how could there be 40 million people in the world infected with an incurable virus and I not know a single one of them? And it launched me on this this journey. I went to bed that night, and all I could hear, truly, I could see those children orphaned, and I could hear their cries. I could hear the dying moans of men and women dying with AIDS, and it haunted me. It just haunted me. And for about a month, then I had this dialogue with God where I basically said, leave me alone. Leave me alone. I don't know anything about this. This is a medical disease. I was a home ec major in college. What do I have to contribute to this? What could one person possibly do about that many orphans? And it just seemed like this ridiculous moment in which I really just needed to tell God to back off and leave me alone. And but after about a month of these nightly dreams and turning on the TV and there'd be another story about AIDS or something, I realized I had come to the proverbial fork in the road. And I could either stay with my comfortable life just exactly the way it was and pretend like I had never read that article, or I could decide that there was something here that God was calling me to become an advocate. And so I finally felt like I walked up to the edge of a precipice, and I said yes and jumped in, and had no plan, no agenda, didn't know a thing. Everything I did know was wrong, and I had to come back and first to God and to say, God, I'm so sorry that I have ignored your sons and daughters on this earth, that I have ignored them, that I have had prejudice, I have been angry, I've been hostile, I have been apathetic. And then from there to say, break my heart. And he did. And there's hardly a day in these 10 years that I don't.
Thank you. Thank you.
Still weep.
Thank you, Kate. McDonald, describe your process.
Yeah, for me, it's been a long journey. It's been a journey that started in my own family when I had my brother sick. My firstborn brother, who got sick soon after he started pursuing his PhD. And he started complaining for some time until one day when he was referred to a hospital somewhere out of the country without us knowing what was the trouble with him. And we eventually, my late father, got a phone call that my brother was diagnosed HIV positive, and he was going to spend only 3 months. Mm. And the doctors wanted somebody in the family to talk to him. We were all in our country. We had nothing to do. We felt so desperate and helpless. But then my father called me and said, look here, you are the priest or the clergy in this family. Can you pick up your courage and talk to your brother? So I said, yes, I can. And then my father talked to the doctor, and the doctor said, let me talk to McDonald first before he talks to his brother. So we had a conversation with the doctor, and then I talked to my brother later and said, well, we are waiting you here. Come back home, and then we'll be with you. Be assured of our love. And my brother lived for about 5 more years from then. But in the course of those 5 years, there were others within the family who were caught in the web, and eventually they passed on before my own brother, my brother passed on. I lost 3 of my siblings in my family, my brother inclusively later on, and that to me started being a challenge. And at the same time, being a parish priest, I saw a lot of orphaned children coming to my house. I didn't know why they were coming to my house, because I was a young priest, and then at that time they couldn't leave. And I kept asking my young brother was young then, very young, why are your friends here up tonight? And I realized those kids had nowhere to go to find love and care. So we had to look after them. They had to get their meals there. And then that drove me into the HIV and AIDS work to date. And the other stories are addition. But certainly, that was the genesis of my journey.
Thank you very much. How about you?
And for me, it is Thailand is a country where most of the people are Buddhist. So after the pandemic was very high, and many monks are working, but I am working in a university, in a Buddhist university. So I teach the monks. That is actually my work. But when I have a time to form a Buddhist monk network on the development work in Thailand, which is long back, and I come to know that there are many monks working on HIV/AIDS in the community, and they are very lonely. And whenever they have a problem, whatever kind of problem occur in their work, so they have no way to no place to communicate. Therefore, we start having just a group of those who are working on HIV/AIDS to discuss, and then that start that I start to work with amongst who are working with people living with HIV. I personally do not work with people living with HIV, but it is, I think, my work, which is given by the Buddha, which he says, when he sent his first group of missionary to please the people, he said that, you know, go, my monk, for to teach and to work for the benefit of the people, of the many. And according to the teachings also, it is very good example of the Buddha himself, that when he saw the his monk, his follower, monks who are in the position of getting sick, he himself go there to clean the body of of the monks, of the sick monk, and care for that monks. So he is a good example for the Buddhist monk to do the work for, you know, those who are seeking health, especially those who are living with HIV.
Thank you. From this personal inspiration, you all built organizations. I'd like to get a little bit of a sense of what was that like? What were some of the challenges, the obstacles, the constraints that you experienced as each of you were building your organizations? The organization you built is an interfaith organization. There might be some particular challenges that you confronted in building your organization, but I'd like to get a sense from each of you what kinds of dynamics you experienced, and perhaps we could begin with yours in Thailand.
If we look at the formation of the interfaith network, it is not very easy because we have a different faith. But, you know, with those people who are getting together, they are very open, with the open mind to learn from one another. That is very important. For Buddhist monk, they have lack of something, especially the knowledge of on HIV/AIDS. But the father of the Catholic Church, they are doing their work to take care of people living with HIV, and they run in Thailand. They run the hospital. And the pastor, they have the home for children. So with these different experiences of the faith leader, it is a very good opportunity to share. And when we share the experience, then we know that it is time for us to start having a network of faith-based organization. And one more important challenge is that how can we accept the different faith, I mean different belief of the people? And in INET, or Interfaith Network on HIV/AIDS in Thailand, we try to start from each religion, like Muslim a community, a Muslim leader, try to pick up the teachings from the Quran, and for the Buddhist monk also to learn from, you know, and the monks in Buddhist community, they also try to dig the teachings from the Tipitaka, from the Buddhist canon, you know, to integrate in their own work. It is really very very challenging for all the leader of the religion to accept and to learn from one another.
Thank you. Kay, was it challenging bringing together some of the folks from Saddleback to embrace a project that was another part of the world in a way that perhaps the church hadn't been engaged before?
You know, I love my church, and I'd say the people in our church were so responsive. I mean, I wish I could say that everybody was, and that just wouldn't be accurate, because obviously there are people who are still living with the same kind of They're sitting in the same chair I was sitting in 10 years ago, which is apathetic and uncaring. But I would say in general, our church has been very responsive. Our challenge was, what can we do on a practical basis? We're not an NGO, we're not a relief organization, we're a church, we're a local church. So what can we do that will take, that will be practical in our area, both domestically and globally? Because when I came back from my first two trips to Africa, the second being Malawi, I told McDonald, first was Mozambique, the second was Malawi, I came back saying, okay, so here I am caring about people who live thousands of miles away from me, but have I done anything for anybody in my own community? And the answer was absolutely not. I'd done nothing for anyone who was HIV positive where we live. So we wanted to build a ministry that was what we call global. It was global and local at the same time. So we eventually came up with what we call an acrostic called CHURCH, which is what are some practical steps that every church can do, whether you're in Darfur or Detroit or Djibouti or, you know, any place else. What is it that's transferable that every church can do? So we use this acrostic to teach other churches who want to start, who really want to make a difference in the AIDS pandemic, that every church can care for and support the sick. Doesn't cost any money to care for and support the sick. We were looking for things that were low cost, that didn't depend on a lot of staff, that didn't depend on a lot of resources, that every church could care for and support the sick. Every church could handle HIV testing. Every church could make sure that people knew their status and that the pastor could lead the way, being the one to be tested. We said that every church and that you could unleash volunteers. The church is huge. The church is scattered all over the world. There are billions of people who claim to be Christians. So what if those volunteers could be mobilized? We said that every church could remove the stigma. Again, it costs no money to remove the stigma. It's not a sin to be sick. That every church could champion healthy behavior, that the church has the moral authority to talk about behavior change and to talk about evidence-based prevention methods, that both are needed. We call it slow and stop, how to slow the pandemic and how to stop it. And that every church could also help with HIV medication, be adherence coaches, treatments. So we have been teaching that both in our church, in our own ministry for people who are positive, and then as we, in Rwanda, work in Western Rwanda, it's applying those same principles. What can every church do? So the challenge really was just finding what are those practical steps.
Thank you. Thank you. McDonald, you were motivated by a vision to create this organization. How difficult was it bringing some of your colleagues along with you?
Yeah. Let me say some of the challenges that were there almost 30 years ago when the epidemic started are still there. There are people like Kay said, there are others who are still sitting where they used to sit, and they are comfortable to sit where they are. But one thing that I've realized in the effort to address HIV challenges our comfort zones and really wants to drive us into a shift that conforms to the core of God. I draw inspiration from Desmond Tutu's statement where he said, does HIV ask a church anything new? He responds to say no. HIV is asking the church to be the church that it has to be, rather than anything new. And so again, I also draw inspiration from St. Augustine of Hippo, who says, is the church a museum of saints or a workshop of sinners? And he says, it's perhaps both. let's avoid to make the church a museum of saints, because we are a church militant and not a church triumphant yet. So there are still some pockets of resistance, and they continue to be there. There are issues of capacity that continue to hurt or to disturb our responses for implementation and planning of programs. There is also emphasis of one side of the divide than the others. There are others who are comfortable to emphasize on one side. And yet, like I alluded to earlier, HIV is not just one side. It's so comprehensive and dynamic. And then there is the continuing, when you talk of faith communities, just look up front here. There's only one lady. There is male domination. And yet HIV continues in my part of the world. It continues to carry a female face. And where are women, and how can women be empowered to ensure that they make decisions in as far as responding to the epidemic is concerned? So those are some of the critical challenges that I continue to face.
Thank you very much. Kay, would you like to pick up on that last point regarding your experience as a woman leader taking on this challenge?
For me, I've been really fortunate because my husband and I are really a team. And so in my particular case, it's been just something that we've done together, we've cared about together. And I think that's been a powerful model, actually, in the conservative circles in which I run, to be a husband and wife team who are sharing ministry together and talking about HIV. But you're exactly right. That continues to be a challenge where women's voices are not heard, where women are not always given the opportunity to speak about their own lives. And as I was thinking about that this morning, thinking of how churches can engage women more is in starting to that place of listening, of listening to women's voices, of recognizing that they are. I love Nick Kristoff's book and his wife Cheryl Wudun on, you know, half the sky, that women are half the sky. We hold up half the sky. And so in the work that we've been doing is engaging both men and women, because it's a holistic, it's not just a disease of men, it's not just a disease of women, even though women predominantly around the world are infected. But how the church can, and I loved what you talked about, gender-based violence, and we see that as something that the church can to address to help women dramatically, is to, we call it a discipleship issue, meaning that when people come to faith and they become Christians, part of growing in their spiritual faith and their maturity, their discipleship, if you will, is that they understand the role of men and women, meaning that men and women are equal in God's sight, and for men around the world to learn to treat women and girls and small children as valuable, that it's not okay to beat your wife, it's not okay to beat your children, it's not okay. And the sad thing is that we have found that is epidemic in the church around the world. It's not just something that happens in families that have no faith. This happens in families of faith. And it's an ugly topic that we don't like to talk about, but we can make a dramatic impact on the AIDS pandemic when men in churches, that's one of the places churches can really shine, to talk about that gender-based violence is unacceptable. It's unacceptable to treat children as anything other than valuable and worthy. And when we do so, then we raise that place of women in children and will affect the pandemic.
Thank you. Thank you. McDonald mentioned a moment ago the depth of engagement over 30 years. When we think about success, effectiveness, the depth of the enduring commitment over a long period of time has what differentiated the most effective programs from others. I want to ask you each about your own experiences in country, trying to sustain the political will within a country to sustain a commitment to ensuring the effectiveness of intervention. McDonald, in your country, you've just gone through a political transition. And I wonder, in your context, whether the role of the faith community was ensuring that a focus was sustained through that process. And I know in Thailand, the importance of being able to sustain that light on the issue. I just want to get your thoughts regarding the role that faith communities can play in sustaining political will. You want to tell us a little bit about your own experience?
If we look at the case of Thailand, it is because of many sectors, not only the faith-based organization. We work collaboratively, and we push on the issue, you know, into the policy of the government. And For the faith-based organization, we also try now very much to encourage the high level of religious leader, especially those who are in the authority, who make the decision, especially the like in the Buddhist order, in the Buddhist society, we have a supreme patriarch and we have a council of the elder. And in also, I think you all know that in the Catholic Church or in the Protestant tradition, they have the authority. And most of the Christian community are not very difficult. But for us, especially for the Buddhist authority and for the Muslim authority, it is a bit difficult for us. But anyway, we with the program that under the Global Fund, we try to have that advocacy for the policy of those who are in the authority of the Buddhist Buddhist belief and of the Muslim community to have more engaged. And they are very, you know, very open to come to participate and to exchange their idea on the issue of HIV and AIDS. It is very interesting. And more than that, we try to bring them and to get their idea of how to deal with the pandemic, which is which we can get a very good idea also from the authority to start our work and to continue our work and to collaborate with the government. And to the government in Thailand, it is I think in almost in all country, HIV/AIDS may be the responsibility of the health minister. But what we are trying to do, and we try to encourage, is that the non-health sector or non-health organization in within the government is also very important. So like those who are working in the religious affair, they are also coming and joining us, you know, to work. So it is a good sign in Thailand that we are now coming together and try to work collaboratively.
Okay, you mentioned that President Kagame was the one who invited you in. How have you negotiated the balance between your direct engagement in addressing the challenge while managing some of the political dynamics within region?
Sure. Well, that's always a delicate dance because we are there at the will of you know, the country and of and particularly the pastors. But you know, I think what I would say about that is that what I believe is that you can't put your faith in a government because they change and regimes change and grants run out and administrations change and President Kagame won't always be in office in Rwanda. There'll be another president. That's why the church has to remain the focus, because the church is durable. It's going to last. It's going to stay even when, you know, President Kagame will someday leave office, and even if the person who replaces him is either different or better, we hope it's even someone, I mean, even more fabulous than President Kagame, and he's a wonderful leader. But the idea is that our faith is not in the government. It really is in what a church can do. It's going to stay. It's going to be there. It's in the community when everybody else is gone, when some NGO has pulled out because their time is done, when a grant has run out, when the money dries up. If the church is still strong and vibrant and involved in the community, the project, the work will go on. And so we try to just make sure that our confidence is not in government. We collaborate, we work, we love it, but our confidence is in the fact that the church is going to remain in the community, and that's where the work will continue.
Thank you. McDonald, has the faith communities been a stabilizing influence ensuring a continuity of focus on HIV/AIDS in Malawi, and how did you manage the transition in leadership?
Yeah, thank you for that question. Let me start on the onset to say that faith communities are widely acknowledged as a conscience of society in Africa. They play a very critical role. They have authority and respect of the populations in Africa. And to that extent, I think faith communities are enablers, and they obviously, they can't be left out. What we need to do and we continue to do is to work in partnership, realizing that government has a role, and that as faith communities, we also have a role, and the international community has its own role, and making sure that we maximize benefits where on what we can do best and avoid claiming a monopoly of wisdom, because sometimes the more we want to do everything and we tend to overstretch ourselves to the extent that we passionately do wrong things at the wrong time. The other thing that we ensure is to provide positive reinforcement where we can provide positive reinforcement, and make sure that the government is also that we create demand as from the people, and making sure that the government provides and accounts for what it provides to the population. Certainly, it's a constitutional obligation that our constitution clearly spells out that government has a duty to its citizens. However, let me say that there are some faith groups here in the West that have been a force to pull us back, where we have seen some positive moves in countries, where leaders in our countries have demonstrated the acumen that they can change the situation. Unfortunately, the Western influence has come to say, no, don't do that. That is bad. Mm-hmm. To the extent that some leaders have pulled back and said, wait a minute, these people are now cautioning us. A level of impudence that has tended to come from the West to the African peoples, to undermine the potential that is there, that people in Africa, they need is, they don't need to be indoctrinated. African people can think on their own. All what they need is, can you provide the positive reinforcement where necessary?
Thank you. Thank you very much. We're going to need to bring this to a close in a few moments. So I'd like to ask you to think forward for a minute. Imagine we're gathering together again in a decade, and we've been able to achieve all of your goals. You're able to achieve what you dream could happen over the course of the next decade if our faith communities are able to realize their full promise and their full potential. How will we be describing the nature of the engagement of our faith communities, say, a decade from now, if the kind of work that we hope can unfold takes place? Let's start in your engagement.
I think we cannot be away from the community, since faith-based organization or the faith community is there in the community. So it is our duty to do the work for the community. So to my experience, I've seen many monks working, and then they start stopping to to accept the financial support from the outside, like in the case of the work under the global fund, many temple and many churches, you know, stop having, you know, the global fund support because they can stand on their own. By, you know, by this continuing support from the outside, it is helping for the faith-based organization to stand by their own. And I think when the financial organization was going to support the faith community, then they just keep some time to support, and then when they can stand by their own, then you can stop doing that. Yes.
Thank you. Kay?
I'm so resonating with what both of you just said and completely agree that that we need a revolution in the way that we do the West and the global North, the way that we're talking in missions in particular, that instead of it being church-based where people from the West come and tell other people what they need to do, just that recognition that the church in Malawi knows what the church in Malawi needs to do. The church in Malawi doesn't need anybody coming and telling you what to do. Church in Rwanda didn't need us coming and telling. In fact, we have tried with such a humble space of, you tell us, you teach us. We're here if we can give you encouragement, if we can give people support, but it's not a financial model. And I think that has been a mistake that we have made in our attempts to help people, is we just truly throw money at things and somehow think that fixes everything. And it doesn't, and the intentionality of the peace plan is all about local indigenous church initiated, where the dreams and the plans and the goals and the work is done through, by, for the local church. And so if I were to look forward 10 years, I would love to see thousands of local churches, millions of churches around the world strengthened to understand that they have within themselves the capacity, the strength, the dignity, the ideas, the dreams, the will, the skill to do what needs to be done. And that if anything, those of us in the global north are coming alongside just saying, teach us everything you know. Because you know things about God, you know things about how to do that we don't know. So that our position is that of a humble learner and a partner linking arms rather than any kind of that old model of we will tell you and you will do what we say. So I love what you're saying. I love what you're saying. It's got to be that collaboration. And we don't take any government money. We don't take any government money, and there's nothing wrong with that. But we just believe that there's a lot that people can do on their own.
Thank you. McDonald, we give you the last word on our panel today.
Yeah, to me, it's evidence. Evidence is very critical. If adequately utilized, the faith community can contribute immensely to the continuing disturbing numbers of new infections, death, and stigma. Perhaps what we need is a renewed commitment by the faith community to scale up our response to the epidemic by thinking broader and avoiding complacency and comfortability, and moving and allowing the epidemic to challenge us from where we sit. Certainly that will create hunger for us to do more within the limited scope of space and time and resources that we have.
Thank you. It's been a privilege. It's been a privilege for me to be a part of this conversation with you all today. And please join me in expressing our gratitude to our distinguished panel for this presentation. And thank you all for being here for this panel today. Good afternoon.